This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1957, a market researcher named James Vickery coined the phrase subliminal messaging. After allegedly flashing short messages like eat popcorn during a crowded film screening, he claimed to observe dramatic boosts in snack sales. Years later, Vickery admitted to having fabricated the study, but the concept of subliminal advertising stuck. Since then, the psychology behind advertising has grown more sophisticated, the neurological effects more studied, and its methodology more cunning. Dr. David Lewis is author of The Brain Cell, When Science Meets Shopping. The book explores, among other topics, how retailers are influencing our decision-making, sometimes without our knowledge. Dr. David Lewis, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Hello. Hi, Virginia.
So, Dr. Lewis, you write about and study what is going on inside of the brain when we are shopping, when we're searching for something. Tell us what happens when we find a bargain.
Well, we all like to find a bargain. In fact, we've done research in America, in New York and in Boston, where we've wired people up when they're in places where you can buy things, let's say fashion items, at a very considerable discount. And we've actually seen surges of excitement in the brain and also in the body, increased heart rate, for example, increases in skin conductance, which is a measure of how excited people are when they spot a bargain, where they, for example, spot a handbag which they might have expected to pay, I don't know, $500 or $600 for, when it's actually been reduced by half or a third. So this does give us a buzz of excitement. And other studies using a technique called fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, has actually shown changes in the way in which the brain is working when we're presented with something. We all of us like to feel we're smart. We all of us like to feel we're given a bargain, finding a bargain. Unfortunately, very often it's not really a bargain. It's merely designed to make us think we've got a bargain.
You clue us into this concept of the atmospherics, this crafted atmosphere. What is it, and how do retailers use atmospherics to influence our purchases?
Atmospherics are a very important concept now in retailing. In fact, most stores will try and create a very special atmosphere. They'll do this in a number of ways. They'll do this by the design of the store, obviously the design of the displays. They'll do it by the way it's lit, the colours which they use. They'll also do it by different aromas. By injecting a particular aroma into a store, you can significantly increase the sales of particular items. So if any of your listeners are in major stores now, they may just kind of pause and sniff. If, for example, they're in the travel department, they may well find that there's a slight odor of coconut oil. And that's been shown to actually increase people's desire to purchase holidays in the sun. Particularly works in Northern Europe, where we don't get quite as much sun as you do in lots of parts of the States. So by injecting coconut oil into the atmosphere, people are subconsciously reminded of putting, you know, sun cream on other people's bodies or their own bodies when they're lying in the sun. So that's one technique. A very interesting study conducted in Belgium. They infuse the aroma of chocolate into bookshops. These levels of chocolate aroma were so slight that people couldn't actually usually detect them consciously, but nonetheless they affected their behavior in the bookshop. They made people stay longer in the bookshop where there was a chocolate aroma, and interestingly they also tended to buy more copies of a book. I mean, unfortunately for authors like myself, these were not the kind of books I write, but they were actually romantic fiction. And so if you're a romantic fiction novelist, then you perhaps should encourage your publishers to inject chocolate into the bookshops when you have your books on display.
And it's not just in shops. You write about in South Korea, Dunkin' Donuts pumping the smell of coffee into buses whenever their ads played over the radio.
Yes.
Is smell the next frontier here in terms of keying into people's impulse to buy?
Oh, yes. Scent is aroma is terrifically important, hugely important. I was speaking with the with one of the executives of a major company in the States called Scentair, and they supply millions of aromas around the world, and they will craft an aroma. They will actually create aroma, like artists will create a painting or a sculptor. They'll create an aroma which kind of gives the brand image. So for Hugo Boss, for example, they created a particular aroma which which, you know, was designed to add to the value to the brand. So aromas are very, very important, and so too is music. In one study, for example, they found that in a wine shop, when they played classical music, people bought more expensive wine. They didn't buy more wine, but they tended to go for the higher priced bottles of wine, rather than if they were playing sort of pop music, then they tended to go for Plonk.
Let's go further into this kind of immersive crafted environment. Mm-hmm. Disney Enterprise is known for creating one of the most immersive shopping experiences in the world. Clue us into how visitors to the park are being manipulated.
Yeah, absolutely. The Disney corporations are absolutely the masters of creating atmospherics. They create an atmosphere which is very conducive to people not only wanting to go to their various parks, but also wanting to stay there for a long time. So when you arrive, for example, at the Disney World in Florida, for example, one of the things is false perspective. So the Cinderella's castle in Disney World has got actually false perspective, which makes it look even bigger than it actually is. So the length of the street as you're walking up towards the castle looks longer, further away when you arrive and you're fresh, but it looks shorter when you're tired and you're coming back home to the car park.
Dr. David Lewis is with us. He's co-founder and director of research at Mind Lab International, and he's written a new book called The Brain Cell, When Science Meets Shopping. We're looking at how various techniques of retailers and advertisers and marketers work on human beings. Besides the atmosphere of places, there's been a lot of emphasis on good customer service in recent years as a way to, you know, keep loyalty. Are those interactions that we get in customer service with big companies like Disney or even Apple stores, are they scripted? Are they natural? Or is this all calculated?
It very much depends on the corporation. Apple, for example, spend a huge amount of time training their sales staff, the people they call geniuses. They have a genius training manual. And there are certain do's and don'ts in a lot of shops. For example, I understand that at Apple, a salesperson will never refer to an Apple computer or an Apple tablet having a problem, because problem is a negative, it's a pejorative word, so they'll refer to it in some other ways. Another technique which is widely used, not just by Apple, but it's a very traditional technique, is the feel, felt, found technique. So, for example, I want to buy, let's say, a tablet. And I say to the salesperson, well, I'm not sure. I've always used a laptop with a keyboard, and I really like keyboards, and this one hasn't got a keyboard, and I'm not sure I'll get on with it. And the salesman will say, or the salesperson will say, I know exactly how you feel. I felt precisely the same way when I first pick up a tablet, but I have found that in a very short space of time, you get used to not having a keyboard or something like that. So feel, felt, found is a way of kind of engendering empathy, understanding the customer's problems, and then providing a solution. Because essentially, that's what selling is. Selling is providing a solution to the customer's problem. Now, it may be a problem they didn't actually know they had before they came into the store. And what new marketing techniques are trying to do is actually get inside the head of the consumer to understand what kind of problems they're likely to present or be interested in accepting they've got.
Dr. Lewis, you're describing what some advertisers have called the hurt heal kind of proposition, right? You know, you identify a need that needs to be healed, a hurt that needs to be healed. Mm-hmm. And some of this seems quite basic to me. You know, you say you've got a problem, we can solve it. You smell coffee, you buy coffee. Yep. So does discovering which neurons fire or what happens inside the amygdala when we see a combination of colors or a certain font wholly change the game of marketing, or just measure what gets triggered by these tried and true tricks?
First of all, I think it enables advertisers to tweak, let's say, a television commercial, so it has the maximum impact on the demographics it's aimed at. And we do a lot of work in our lab looking at web usability. Of course, so much shopping now is done by clicks rather than going into bricks. Then you have to be able to engage the consumer at a very, very, very rapidly, because people online, perhaps you are yourself, are very impatient. If they don't get the answers very quickly, they're likely to click to another site. So it's all about where do you put your particular messages? Where do you position the brand? What color should the background be? And by making these subtle changes, which you can identify using techniques like neuromarketing, I think you can greatly increase your sales. The second area which people are very interested in is how quite small things can have a big impact. So, for example, looking at fonts, that the way in which the typeface is presented. We offered people a tomato soup to eat. And we gave them a menu which described the soup as delicious tomato soup. And we had two groups. One got a menu printed in what is called courier font, and that's quite a drab font. Mm-hmm. The other was printed in a very flowing calligraphic script. And we asked them to rate the taste of the soup. And those who'd seen the menu in a very elegant font actually rated it as much tastier, and they said they were more likely to buy it. But in fact, it was exactly the same soup. We served it from the same can.
Well, you know, your advice is something that a lot of marketers would take up. They think, okay, we're changing our font. But how about for the people who are trying to resist the urge to impulse buy or overspend, given that so much customer persuasion is happening on a deep subliminal level? Have you got any advice for protecting ourselves from that?
Absolutely. I think I would say that, first of all, and I'm sure, you know, your listeners are savvy enough shoppers to know you should never go shopping for food when you're hungry.
Right.
Because you will overbuy. But that aside, I think you should be aware of three things. First of all, however nice they are, and they're trained to be nice, and they're probably very nice people themselves, sales agents are not your friends. You know, you are there to be sold to. And so their friendliness and their empathy and their understanding, although it may be perfectly genuine, is not an example of genuine friendship. So be aware that the purpose of a sales interaction is for them to sell you something. The second thing I would say is give your brain time to catch up with your emotional responses. Step back. The worst phrase any salesperson can hear is, "I'll think about it," because they know if the customer thinks about it, they probably may not, if it's an impulse buy, want to buy it. So, you know, as you say, step back from the situation. And I think the other thing I would say is be quite cautious about, I mean, people talk about neuromarketing in kind of, you know, 1984 terms, the brave new world and all this kind of thing. In fact, I think a much greater danger to our privacy lies in the way in which big data is being analyzed. This is a whole range of things, from everything from the information provided by your credit card, your debit card, your loyalty card, the information you give away free on social media. This information is extremely important and extremely valuable to people in advertising, marketing, and retailing. And they analyze it in order to try and develop messages which matter to you personally, rather than sort of broadcasting an advert to a million people. They actually want to speak to you, Virginia, as an individual, because if they can do that, if they really understand your likes and dislikes, then they have a much better chance of selling to you. But you've got to bear in mind, on the web, there is nothing. There is no such thing as a free lunch. If you're not a customer on the web, then you're a commodity. And the commodity which is being traded is your personal information.
Well, how about you? You're selling a book. Any kind of messaging you're doing to drive sales?
Well, I mean, yes, selling books is very important, particularly to publishers and to authors as well. We all like to feel that people are interested in our work. But I mean, absolutely, the position on the shelf is hugely important. And people tend to think that a product on the shelf is just on a particularly good shelf, say a right-hand shelf at eye level or just below eye level, because it is. But in fact, it's there because big companies pay a lot of money to supermarkets in order to have their product there. Mm. Yeah, I mean, if I'm in a bookshop and I see my book right down on the bottom, so people have got to bend down, I must admit I will probably move it up a few shelves. You know, I'll use that knowledge. But we actually, we tested the cover. We actually used neuromarketing to test the cover because, you know, designers of book covers, who I think are immensely clever in most cases, produce a whole range of things. So we put ours to the test, and we used neuromarketing to test which of the cover designs was likely to be most effective. So, you know, time will tell.
Well, we bought it.
Indeed.
Dr. David Lewis, co-founder and director of research at MindLab International. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
His new book is called The Brain Cell: When Science Meets Shopping. While many consumers are swayed by advertising, one movement in the 1970s was staunchly anti-commercial: punk rock. When Word of Mouth continues, the punk scene's role in the surprisingly fascinating history of the safety pin. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Safety pins. They are small, sharp, sometimes critical, but seemingly unremarkable. On Closer Look, the history of the cloth diaper closures and in-a-pinch wardrobe modifiers is a bit more fascinating. Can't help myself. Writer Ted Kolcheski is a contributor to Worn Fashion Journal. His article, Safety Dance, How the Safety Pin Became a Revolutionary Fashion Accessory, is one of those collected in what is called the first ever Worn Archive. It's an anthology of their issues. Ted Kolcheski, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Walter Hunt, the inventor of the safety pin, who I guess was pretty much in a bind when they sold a patent for his invention. Can you give us the story?
Yeah, well, from what I understand, he came from upstate New York and came from a family of 13 children and had a good number of children himself. And also, from what I understand, might have been a bit of a gambler. So he was often in debt. But apparently he was good with his hands and had a bit of a mechanical mind. So he struck it well with Subway Bell. It occurred to him, he saw a kid get struck by a streetcar, and it occurred to him, why didn't they ring the bell? Why did that kid get hit? And so he invented one that could be pushed with the operator's foot, which netted him a bit of money. So then he spent a lot of time trying to come up with inventions. And one day, his back was against the wall, and he was fiddling with a piece of wire. He was like, if only I could invent something with this piece of wire that could earn me a patent, and he came up with the safety pin.
And did he get a patent?
Apparently he sold, didn't have the money to deal with the patent office and stuff like that, so he sold it to a company for about $400.
Oh boy, $400.
Well, that's about $10,000 in today's money. So
that, it's a fair bit of money, but it's kind of like the doorknob. I mean, everybody uses them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So how did hygiene factor into its rising popularity?
The big thing was, at that point in time, people had just discovered the microscope and had discovered germs. Mm-hmm. So there was a bit more awareness, particularly with infants, about how clean they were going to be. So previous to that, people had reused a lot of very sturdy, durable, sort of leather diapers for children with elaborate tying systems on them. The idea of a cloth that you could wash on a daily basis seemed to be much more clean to a lot of people, and the safety pin came along at just the right time to accommodate those cloth diapers.
So later, long after cloth diapers had taken a dive, the safety pin made the jump from diaper fastener to fashion accessory and political statement. This was in the 1970s. What was the story there?
There was an explosion on New York's Lower East Side, of a music that even before it was called punk, it was just a bunch of bands writing original music that wasn't exactly in step with the more dancey or experimental progressive musics of the day. And one of the bands, Television, the bass player and sometime vocalist Richard Hell, was well known for wearing his everyday clothes on stage at that point. And of course, this is the era of bands like Kiss and the Bay City Rollers and this sort of thing, where very Elton John, so very elaborate stage outfits were the norm. And this band was starting to make a bit of a name for itself by wearing their street clothes. Now, legend has it from a few different people that Richard Hell's street clothes had been ripped up to shreds and he had a show coming up. So he bought a package of safety pins and safety pinned his clothes back together. It's always struck me as a little odd, but apparently the photographer Bob Gruen says that what had happened was his girlfriend had actually taken a razor blade to every piece of clothing in his wardrobe during some fight, and he had no choice but to, at that point, safety pin things back together.
Oh, boy.
Richard Hell has just last year came out with an autobiography where he denies the whole thing, but I'm skeptical because it comes from so many sources. But by almost common consent, he was the first one to wear the safety pin as a fashion statement.
Well, I find that so interesting because I actually thought it must have started in the UK. But you say it actually became a staple of New York City's punk scene and then migrated to the UK.
Yeah, well, Malcolm McLaren, who was the sort of marketing wing of Vivienne Westwood's
The fashion designer.
The fashion designer. She was an up-and-coming fashion designer, and Malcolm McLaren was sort of her manager/retailer. he had come over to New York and had dipped his toe, and it had occurred to him that having a band might be a good advertisement for some clothes that were going on. So he offered to manage a few New York bands that were around at the time, but most notably suggested to some of the kids hanging around Vivian Westwood in his store in London that maybe they'd want to start wearing the safety pin as a statement.
Well, a few attempts at a comeback with the safety pin. Vivian Westwood even brought it back in gold a couple of years ago. How'd it go over?
Well, you know, she keeps bringing it back, as far as I can tell. Like, right now on her website, she's got a gold phallic safety pin, which emphasizes some of the more male aspects of the safety pin, that she's hawking in gold and rose for $75 a pop. So I think it's probably a steady earner for her, especially with... There was a big exhibit at the Met last year, I guess, for punk and fashion. So I can't see how it wouldn't continue to be a fair source of inspiration for her.
Ted Kolchesky, thank you for this little, I guess, unknown history of the safety pin in fashion.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ted Kolchesky is a writer. He's also a contributor to the Worn Fashion Journal. His article, Safety Dance, How the Safety Pin Became a Revolutionary Fashion Accessory, is one of those published in what is called the Worn Archive. It is an anthology of the first, 14 issues of the Worn Fashion Journal. You can find more at wordofmouthradio.org. Word of mouth continues with a woman whose wit targeted the fatuous, comfortable status quo as sharply as any safety-pinned punk rocker, the irrepressible Sandra Bernhard. She'll join us to talk about which buttons she feels need pushing in 2014. That's after the news from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Welcome to Sandyland, a place where you won't find gumdrop mountains, but plenty of sharp observations on celebrity and pop culture. It's where you will hear wry reflections on childhood, maybe punctuated by an enthusiastic belting out of Miley Cyrus's Wrecking Ball. It's where you must expect the unexpected and where Sandra Bernhard is queen. Sandyland is Bernhard's latest one-woman show, and it will bring her to New England this weekend. She's performing Sandyland at Plymouth State University Center for the Arts this Friday and at Jonathan's in Agunquit, Maine on Saturday. I'm so pleased to welcome Sandra Bernhard to Word of Mouth. Hello.
Great to be here.
What can people expect when they visit Sandyland?
Well, you're going to be taking a journey with me that sometimes I don't even know where I'm going. So maybe I'll be as surprised as you are where we end up. So really, it's really like a one-woman tour de force.
Well, I read that seeing Carol Channing, speaking of Madcap, playing Hello, Dolly, was a defining moment for you.
Yes, it was. I was 8 years old. My parents took me to see her in Flint. I lived in Flint, Michigan, in Detroit at the Fisher Theater. And it was in previews before she opened on Broadway. So it was really fresh and new. And the costumes were just so divine. And you know, the feathers and the dancing waiters and, you know, just the incredible Carol Channing energy that just swept everybody away. I mean, she's just such a great person.
What do you think your 8-year-old self would think seeing you on stage now? Would you allow yourself to go, first of all?
That's funny. Well, you know, I mean, I was quite, had vivid fantasies of how it would be. When I was 8 years old, I would lay in bed at night. That's how I put myself to sleep at night. Instead of having people read me stories, I'd lay there imagining myself on the big stages of New York City and,
wow,
and you know, coming out for my, you know, applause and my second encore. And so it just sort of all sort of fell together beautifully, seamlessly, really.
I guess you have a 15-year-old daughter now. Is she 15, if I got that right?
She's 15, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What would you tell her if she said, I want to be a performer?
She doesn't want to be a performer. She wants to write. And I told her, she's really always coming up with funny observations. And I said, please start keeping a comedy notebook. She said, really? I said, yeah. I said, because you'll look back and you'll be able to use that stuff. And I don't think she has, because kids just don't want to hear that, you know, and they don't want to do it. But she really is funny, and she's a natural. She's a real social commentator, and you know, she watches a film. Matter of fact, I was a little surprised. I wasn't thrilled, but she was watching Wolves of Wall Street the other night, and she goes, "I'm fast forwarding because most of these scenes are unnecessary. They don't move the plot forward, and I don't understand why they're here to begin with." I was like, "Bravo! There's a chip off the old block."
Have you worked with her at all as a writer?
She really is not like a huge fan of my work. She loves me, and so often she'll come to my shows and edit my work. She'll go, "Mom, that piece is way too long. Really, you're boring the audience. It's too much." And she was right about one of the pieces I did, and she was right.
Well, you, Sandra Bernhardt, have been described as fearless, as brash, as outspoken, as sassy. What are some of the boundaries you think need pushing at today?
Well, I think we need to get back to being human. I think with the internet and social media and everybody celebrating themselves constantly on social media, and how little it takes to get attention. I mean, the Kardashian phenomena has just really blown my mind. I really didn't think it was going to hold, and yet it has. And I'm like, wow, what is this? Because really and truly, they don't do anything. They're just like these girls who, you know, came from a little bit of money and parlayed themselves into these celebrities.
It's interesting because that's something you, I feel like, were very out in front with, you know, taking celebrity culture to task
right.
in ways that now might actually seem fairly tame.
Oh, for sure.
Has there been a cost for you to being a pioneer?
I don't think so. I just think there's on that level, on the sort of, you know, pop culture front, there's little to nothing to really critique anymore, only because what was so fun about what I did 15, 20, 30 years ago with magazines like Women's Wear Daily or Vogue or, you know, any of the sort of places that celebrated beauty and superficiality. But there was actual talent there as well. So it was a fun place to go in and just sort of like poke holes and let the air out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And now there just isn't.
Sandra Bernhardt is with us. She is touring through New England this weekend. She'll be at Plymouth State University on Friday and at Jonathan's in Agunquit, Maine on Saturday. Well, I want to just play a little clip of something that attests to your being really out on the front edge. On Roseanne, you played Nancy Bartlett. This was the first openly gay character on network sitcoms. Here's a clip of you coming out from a 1992 episode.
Tell us about the guy.
Yeah,
what's
come
his
on.
Name?
Why don't you tell us? We're just going to bug you till you
know. No, it's too soon. It's too soon. Come on. Tell us.
You big baby.
All right. Her name is Marla. I'm seeing a woman. I'm serious. I'm gay.
You know what's really funny? To hear the audience response. It's almost like watching King of Comedy, which, you know, preceded, again, all of the sort of unbelievable places we've gone, and, you know, in terms of, like, being a star, being famous, and the whole comment on fame, because we just weren't there yet. So when you hear the audience go, oh, gasp, but now they wouldn't even, like, it wouldn't even respond, you know? It's, like, become so second nature for people to be gay and for people to come out. It's like, now it's more like, oh, well, another one, you know? It's just so funny, because the response was genuine.
Yeah, and at that time, I mean, this was 5 years before Ellen came out. I mean, you really were on the edge. I guess that's what I mean by, did it cost you anything to be a pioneer? Did you get sidelined or thought of as, oh, she's the gay character?
Well, I guess to a certain extent. But, you know, my work, my own work has always been toying with, you know, sexuality and the kind of fine line between sexuality and what we all want to be and who we all are. To a certain degree, it affected it. But what was I looking to be? Was I looking to be the girl next door or an ingenue? Because that was never going to happen anyway. So at least I actually can stand on my own, you know, precipice and look out at the vistas of what I've done because I wanted to do.
In 1998, you put on the one-woman show, I'm Still Here, Damn It, and 16 years later, there you are. You're still here.
Yeah.
So what is it? Do you think that accounts for your longevity in a business that, you know, chews up a lot of people and spits them out?
Well, I think precisely that I do my own work and that I've always stood by what I believe and, you know, taken chances and said things that were sometimes a little bit, you know, incendiary and exciting and dangerous. And as the decades pass, you see that, like you said, those things all came to pass and none of them are really all that shocking anymore. Mm-hmm. So the sort of beauty of what I do is like mining new places to go that are revolutionary and unexplored, really.
But that sounds to me like, you know, taking those chances, mining new places, revolutionary work, there's a real vulnerability in it. I wonder if it ever gets scary and exhausting.
You know, it was never really that vulnerable until, like, most recently, like when, you know, like so many performers now, we sort of stop saying certain things because they're taken out of context by people who don't understand it, who are not sophisticated, and they turn it into something that was never intended for it to mean or be. I think I do edit myself, certainly on social media, quite a bit, because where I would say something on stage and not think twice about it, because I know that my audience is there and they get it. On social media, they look at things and take it, you know, verbatim, and then they turn it into this sort of, like, firestorm. Mm-hmm. Of, and then you find you have to spend your time explaining and try to defend yourself. And it's not how a performer wants to live their life. You want to be able to say things and not have to, like, over-explain it because it takes the fun out of it.
Well, it sounds like a lot to look forward to this weekend. Sandra Bernhardt, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm so excited. I love coming up to, you know, to the beautiful Northeast.
Sandra Bernhardt, thank you.
Thank you.
Sandra Bernhardt will be performing her one-woman show, Sandyland, at Plymouth State University's Center for the Arts this Friday and at Jonathan's in Agunquit, Maine on Saturday. You will find ticket information on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
From the top, a 5, 6, 7, 8.
The world of auditioning has always been synonymous with anxiety, stress, and that ultra-competitive hunger for the part. So it's refreshing to arrive at the Sandy auditions and see 60-plus dogs joyfully running around, wagging and slobbering uncontrollably. The only hunger here is for dog treats, which there are plenty of. Billy Butler, the director of Annie, is one of the judges for the audition.
I'm looking for that, you know, that special spark, you know, that's something. You know, the dog with a twinkle in its eye, you know. To me, I'll really look to the owner because their personality will reflect what the dog's like, too. So.
And if these dog owners are reflections of their dogs, I don't think they have anything to worry about, for the most part.
He's very special.
Silly, goofy. He's my Rasta man.
He drools a considerable amount. He's wearing a bib. A friend of mine got it for him. It says Chick Magnet on it.
He's very outgoing. He has a great personality. At least people tell me he has a great personality.
He's usually pretty gentle. He's very friendly. Sometimes he gets a little excited, and then things tend to get broken.
She's madly in love with every other dog.
He's shy. He is a little bit of, yeah, he's a little bit of a chicken.
She's a princess. She wants everything her own way.
He's mellow and sweet and loving and very motivated by food, any kind of food.
As the auditions start, one thing becomes clear. Out of the four judges, there's one who seems to be enjoying herself a little more than the others.
Are you excited about today?
Yes!
Why?
Because, like, I get to see a bunch of dogs and I get to pet them and be so cute. And I have a dog right over there and she's adorable and now I get to see 83 dogs. Wow.
That number is debatable, but her enthusiasm isn't. This is Carly Gendel. She'll be playing the role of Annie and she's a critical part of the audition process. Each dog will be judged on how they interact with her. Do they shy away when she hugs them? Do they come when she calls them? Watching all these interactions is Sue Carney. She's a local dog trainer and the resident dog expert. She was asked to help judge the competition, hopefully seeing hidden signs of greatness or potential disaster.
I think the ultimate goal is to get a dog that has a spark, as well as can handle the sparks that are around it. I think lights and singing and clapping and all the different days that the play's on. The dog has to be able to deal with all of that.
Okay.
That's right.
I'm just going to go through what I really, really like. Very young but adorable is Maggie.
As the day goes on and the judges narrow down the field, spirits stay high. Even for those like Linda and Rupert, experiencing the harsh reality of defeat.
Well, I think I'm feeling a little dejected. But you know what? I think I'm going to get over it. Because there was a fear that I might win, and then I'd have to actually get him there every night. And then a handler and the photos, it would just go to his head. So I think we're better off.
How's he feeling?
He feels that he wants to really play ball.
As the final round of auditioning ends, the judges huddle around, quietly comparing notes. There's only 5 dogs left at this point, but a crowd has gathered around to watch, anxious for the final announcement.
And a drum roll, please. Do you want to announce
the...
Do you want to announce the winner?
Yes! And the winner is... Broccoli!
Well, his name is technically not Broccoli.
His name is Buckley, but I call him Broccoli because it's way more better.
Whatever you want to call him, being Sandy may have always been his fate. Here's his owner, Gene Kane.
Well, I didn't know anything about this.
Oh, you didn't?
And Buckley comes here every day, early in the morning and at night. So we came in this morning and someone said, oh, are you here to have Buckley try out? And I said, for what? And they said, well, to be in Annie. And I said, no, but we could think about it. And I actually took my granddaughter to Annie in New York 2 weeks ago. And she came out and said, Buckley should have been the dog. And he's the next Sandy.
And if Buckley's ever feeling under the weather, he'll have an understudy. Here's director Billy Butler.
Our star is Buckley, named after, I believe his name is William F. Buckley, I believe his name is. And the other one is whiskey, which is great, because I believe that William F. Buckley drank whiskey.
But in all seriousness, there's something uplifting about spending a day with a bunch of happy and joyful dogs, and it washes over everyone.
It was great. Played all day with dogs. I mean, I'm really surprised at... how friendly the dogs were, and like I said, you know, to all the parents of the dogs, it says a lot about them as people. It gives me a little glimmer of hope.
And for those dogs who had their sights set on the spotlight but left with their tail between their legs, there's always, well, you know.
Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun.
For word of mouth, I'm Zach Nugent.
Just thinking about tomorrow.
A hearty congratulations to our own Zach Nugent for that Edward R. Murrow Award-winning piece.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire wildlife officials are wrestling with a proposal that would put them in charge of wolf hybrids. Those are wolves that have been bred with domesticated dogs. These sometimes dangerous animals are often abandoned because they can become unmanageable as pets. NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown reports that a population of abandoned wolf dogs prompted this latest look at an animal that falls squarely in the gray area between wild and tame.
Most dogs have many generations of domestication between them and their wild roots. Wolf dogs have just a few.
They have that wildness to them that's just hard to get out of them.
Tanner Brewer manages the state's largest wolf dog sanctuary in Chatham, up on the Maine New Hampshire border near Conway. He'll tell you that many wolf dogs act just like dogs, whimpering and begging for attention. But they can be huge, some weighing more than 200 pounds, and that wildness sometimes is right on the surface.
We have one wolf dog over here named Rosie that has really taken a liking to me and Matthew, but yet one of the other guys can't even go in the cage. So, and it just goes to show you, you know, I mean, he'd been in there 3 or 4 times and she got his boot one day, you know, just bit his boot.
Brewer, a big guy and an army vet, works for the New England Wolf Advocacy and Rescue Center, or NEWARC. He says the 69 animals here have all been spayed or neutered and vaccinated, which the law requires. They're kept in large pens with 8-foot chain link fences. It was a quiet, sunny day when I visited NEWARC, but in reality, there are storm clouds surrounding this refuge. Last fall, a different wolf sanctuary in Alexandria collapsed, prompting a lot of headlines and scrutiny from lawmakers over how these animals are regulated. Basically, right now, they're treated roughly like domestic dogs. They have to be licensed with local authorities. The Department of Agriculture has rules that require wolf hybrid owners to neuter, vaccinate, and keep them in pens with tall fences, but Ag says it has never enforced these rules because it doesn't have the resources to do so.
Good morning, Glenn Normando, Director of Fish and Game.
The Ag Department says it should be up to Fish and Game, which at a recent hearing said it too has money problems.
You know, we don't have the manpower or the money to be going around confirming that somebody's wolf hybrid is neutered, or that it to look and see what kind of pens people have for these animals. I mean, that's not what our department does.
Wait, says Fish and Game. These are domestic animals. That's not our deal. And Agriculture says, no, no, really, they're wild animals. They should be managed by Fish and Game. And meanwhile, wolf dogs continue to trickle into the state. You can still import wolf hybrids from out of state, and it's illegal to sell them in New Hampshire, but a quick Google search will show you that doesn't mean it's not happening. Refuges like Newark and the one in Alexandria exist because when someone's adorable hybrid puppy grows into a 200-pound sofa-shredding wolf dog, it needs a place to go. But these sanctuaries often operate hand-to-mouth, on the fringes of towns. Donald Sullivan is the chief of police in Alexandria, which hosted the refuge that fell apart so publicly last fall.
The owners of that property wound up getting evicted from the land, which left me in a very tough spot of having a massive amount of these wolf hybrids up on the side of the mountain that I knew the owner was not going to be able to properly remove.
It took 16 days to deal with 40 abandoned dogs. Some had to be euthanized, and a few went to the Humane Society, and the rest went to Newark.
Hi, babies. Hi, babies. What you
Brewer
doing?
Is part of a crew of three from California who recently took over in Chatham. They cobble things together to make it work financially.
Grants and volunteers and donations.
And it's a pretty rustic site, way up on the side of a ridge.
So when we came here, it was just a melee of tools and stuff that had been left behind, people living in trailers everywhere. And we want to get rid of all that, you know, and be able to make some suitable housing.
The Chatham Sanctuary used to be called the Lokai Clan Wolf Refuge. Its founder, Fred Keating, had run-ins with the USDA, who cracked down on him for charging for tours of the site, which technically made it an illegal zoo. Keating fed the animals roadkill and whatever other meat he could rustle up. The refuge's board of directors eventually kicked him out, saying the animals weren't getting proper veterinary care. When Brewer and the others arrived last fall, they found a pile of animal carcasses on the property, years old and including some of the wolf dogs.
This was a boneyard down here that we cleared out and made pens, but every animal had two bullet holes in the head, so that leads you to believe that the animals were still alive when they were brought here.
Now they're building new enclosures, getting the animals on site vaccinated and neutered, and trying to attract new resources. And they hope to do that by employing veterans. According to Matt Simmons, the co-founder of the California refuge that took over in Chatham, it's a model that has worked out west. Simmons is writing grants and trying to start a program called Wolves and Warriors. It works through the VA to hire traumatized veterans to care for rescued wolf dogs.
They'll be able to live at the facility free of charge. They will also get paid while they are there. We will bus them back and forth for medical appointments, and we will give them a chance to heal clean and sober and outside the brick and mortar of the VA hospital.
Meanwhile, a fix for the oversight of wolf dogs in New Hampshire appears to be hung up in the politics of how to enforce the law. Though Simmons thinks simply levying the $1,000 fine for infractions might not be enough.
Some of these animals fetch a price of $10,000 per puppy. When you have eight pups in a litter, why would you care? That's just the cost of doing business.
And while wolf dogs can be difficult pets to own, some people still continue to want to take on that challenge. Ellen Finnessy from Ackworth shared her story with lawmakers.
The family of a friend of our son's when he was about five had a wolf hybrid named Rosie. She was the sweetest thing in the world. She wagged her tail. She was just like a dog.
The bill tweaking the New Hampshire rules is already through the Senate and will be up for a vote in the House in the coming weeks. Whatever lawmakers decide, there are 69 wolf dogs on the Maine-New Hampshire border where they'll live out their lives.
You know, it's our responsibility. We made them this way.
So we made them this way, so they have a right to live just like anything else, you know. And as long as there's places that are available like Newark, then it makes no sense to even think about putting them down.
So for now, they'll be there for wolf dog owners who find they've bitten off a little more than they can chew.
Wolf mother, where you been?
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. In today's connected world, the most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio. Shapeshifters.